For the left in Spain, the war was a disaster that would last for decades, a catastrophic defeat whose scale is hard to exaggerate. But did the human tragedy in Spain have wider political consequences for the rest of Europe? How, if at all, did the defeat of the left affect the wider course of European history? Would a victory for the left in the Spanish Civil War, however improbable, have done anything to prevent another general European war? It seems highly unlikely. How Spain would have turned out under Republican rule after a defeat of Franco's nationalist forces is impossible to gauge. Conceivably, the ultimate beneficiaries might well have been the communists, taking Spain down the route towards left-wing dictatorship. Had the more moderate left triumphed, probably a less likely outcome, it would have given a boost to socialists in Western Europe and offered the West a potential ally in a coming conflict. A possibility might have been to improve the prospects of the mooted Grand Coalition of international forces, including the Soviet Union, to deter Hitler. At least as possible, however, is that a triumph for the left in Spain and France would have provoked more than deterred Hitler, the prime danger to Europe's peace. Spain might even have found itself at a later date the target of German invasion. These are unknowable scenarios. As it was, events in Spain left socialists demoralized. Tens of thousands from over 50 countries, the majority of them communists, who had been fired by idealism to join the international brigades to fight for the Republic, were left bitter at what they saw as the betrayal of the cause by the Western democracies. Spain, however, contributed to the deepening acknowledgement on the left that a lingering belief in pacifism and disarmament couldn't be sustained. Only force of arms could defeat fascism. The civil war that many had feared would be the precursor to the showdown of fascism and Bolshevism in a new European war didn't turn out that way. For all that, Germany, Italy, and the Soviet Union engaged in a proxy conflict in Spain, none was yet ready for a major European war, though Germany was certainly taking steps that would make one inevitable. The Germans, especially, had learnt important tactical lessons about airstrikes in support of ground troops and the need to improve their tanks. They and the Italians had seen what their bombers could do to the civilian population of towns and cities. The Soviets had recognised they couldn't rely on the Western bourgeois powers in defence against the growing menace of fascism. The Western democracies, for their part, felt vindicated that they hadn't been drawn into the conflict. Although the result was a nationalist Spain that could develop still closer ties with the fascist dictatorships, that was better in their eyes than a triumph of Bolshevism close to home. The Civil War lasted a terrible 3 years, blighting Spain for decades to come. It was, however, largely detachable from the main developments that were shaping the continent. Spain had been on the European fringes before the Civil War. For a brief traumatic period, the cataclysmic events in Spain held much of Europe's attention. After 1939, however, Spain once again subsided into a European backwater. Important strategically, once a much bigger war had eventually broken out, but apart from that, receding in wider interest until greatly altered circumstances during the Cold War turned Franco into a prized asset to the West. For the rest of Europe, the events that were leading directly towards another great continental conflagration had little to do with Spain. They were taking place in the pivotal danger area of Central Europe, and they were shaped by a force that the terrible civil war in Spain didn't significantly affect: Germany's relentless drive to expansion. The Arms Race. In Berlin, on the dark and dreary late afternoon of the 5th of November 1937, the commanders-in-chief of Germany's Army, Air Force and Navy, General Werner von Fritsch, General Hermann Göring, also head of the four-year plan, and Admiral Erich Raeder, made their way to the Reich Chancellery to learn Hitler's decision on the allocation of steel to the three services. At least, that is what they thought they were going to learn. Hitler addressed them for 2 hours, though not about the allocation of steel. At first, there was little new. They had heard many times from him before that Germany's future economic security could be assured not by dependence on the vagaries of international markets, but only through the acquisition of living space, Lebensraum. The idea itself, a variant of imperialist ideology reinforced by Germany's exposure to economic blockade during the First World War, and one of Hitler's obsessions since the mid-1920s, implied, of course, expansion and the risk, if not the certainty, of armed conflict at some point. This in itself worried neither the military leaders nor the others present, the war minister Werner von Blomberg, the foreign minister, Konstantin von Neurath, and Hitler's Wehrmacht adjutant, Colonel Friedrich Hosbach. What living space meant in practice had been left open. It covered various notions of future expansion. None necessarily signified war in the near future. What Hitler went on to say, however, was that he was contemplating precisely that possibility. Time wasn't on Germany's side. The current advantage in armaments wouldn't last. He was determined to act by 1943-44 at the latest, but under certain circumstances much earlier. He raised the possibility of attacking Austria and Czechoslovakia even during the coming year, 1938. That worried some of his small audience a great deal. It wasn't that they were concerned about asserting German supremacy in Central Europe or economic dominance of the Danube region, specially favoured by Göring. It was the prospect of war between Germany and the Western powers that triggered their alarm. Germany was nowhere near prepared for a major war, and they knew it. What they had heard left Blomberg, Neurath, and above all, Fritsch, nervous. 3 months later, the sceptics were gone. Hitler had removed all of them from their posts. As 1937 drew to a close, the arms race among Europe's most powerful countries was an increasingly crucial determinant of the actions of governments. Hitler's meeting with his military leaders had ostensibly been about steel allocation, and indeed, the shortages of steel were creating major difficulties for the German rearmament program. Steel production was far too low for the demands of the army. It was imposing drastic constraints on aircraft production, and it left the building of warships lagging far behind the Navy's projected targets. The growing steel crisis had led in the latter months of 1937 to the ousting of the economics minister, Hjalmar Schacht, who had masterminded the economic recovery after 1933, but had more recently raised weighty objections to a military spending program that was running out of control. Göring, head of the four-year plan, the crucial rearmaments program laid down in autumn 1936, was now effectively in charge of the economy and interested in economic management solely to maximize rearmament production and make Germany ready for war in the shortest possible time, regardless of cost. When the industrial barons of the Ruhr balked at the costs of smelting the low-grade iron ores to meet his targets of domestic production, he commissioned three state-owned steelworks to do precisely that. Leaders of German big business, not for the most part enthusiastic about Hitler before he had gained power, had been swift converts thereafter, eagerly eyeing the vast profits to be made from a revitalized economy, an armaments boom, and the anticipated domination of Eastern and Southeastern Europe. Reluctant though the Ruhr steel barons were to invest in low-grade iron ores, they were nonetheless major beneficiaries of the vast state expenditure on rearmament. A huge concern, such as the chemicals giant IG Farben had already seen its profits soar under the demands of the four-year plan, and eye-watering possibilities lay in store as booty from German conquest. Its bosses could be certain to favour expansion into Austria and Czechoslovakia, both of which offered the prospect of major economic gain in the near future. Acquisition, not least of raw materials and industrial potential, ever more urgently needed to sustain the armaments drive in an economy under massive strain. Supply bottlenecks and acute labour shortages were already building up. Over subsequent months, the problems would become increasingly severe. Eventually, they would even bring warnings of an imminent collapse in the Reich's finances. Any normal government would have felt compelled to address the difficulties by reining in expenditure to avoid economic disaster. But the Nazi regime was in no way normal. Hitler's own unchanged view, coming to be shared by weighty sections of the military-industrial complex, was that only war and the acquisition of new economic resources would solve Germany's problems. Far from acting as a brake on Hitler's drive to war, Germany's mounting economic problems reinforced his conviction that war was an urgent necessity. The other European country rearming for the purpose of external aggression was Germany's Axis partner, Italy. The pace of its rearmament was, however, crassly different from that in Germany. Steel production, as in Germany, imposed sharp restrictions on the scale of rearmament. So did dwindling currency reserve. Italian industrialists were happy to maximize their profits from producing arms, but unwilling to risk long-term investment for short-term gain. Poor management and bad mistakes in the commissioning of weapons led to weaknesses both in technology and performance, and many of Italy's scarce resources were wasted through involvement in the civil war in Spain, which was lasting much longer than Mussolini had foreseen when he had been so quick to provide aid to Franco. By the end of 1937, the combination of problems in the Italian economy was beginning to impose significant constraints on rearmament. The state lacked both the industrial capacity and financial strength to push through a rapid increase in rearmament. In fact, as other countries were intensifying their rearmament programs, Italy actually saw a drop of 20% in military spending in 1937-38, compared with the previous year. Mussolini was envisaging up to 5 years before Italy would be prepared for war. Even that reckoning was optimistic. The Soviet leadership had, from 1936, reacted ever more allergically to the growing danger to their country from Germany, allied most likely, it was presumed, with other fascist and imperialist powers. With all branches of industrial production in the hands of the state, in a closed economy and under a brutal dictatorship, there were no constraints on an all-out rearmament drive. Output was nonetheless hampered by inefficiencies, disputes over areas of competence between industry and the army, and structural problems in converting civilian to military production. On top of that came the disastrous purges, themselves at least in part a reflection of Stalin's paranoia about internal enemies who were allegedly threatening Soviet defences. Unsurprisingly, foreign Kremlin watchers took it as axiomatic that the Soviet Union had been seriously weakened and was, certainly for the foreseeable future, not a force to be reckoned with. Despite the massive advances in the rearmament drive, on the basis of the intelligence they were receiving, the Soviet leaders deemed that the gap with Germany, especially in the critical sphere of the quality of air armaments, was widening, not narrowing. It was a worrying thought. For the Western democracies, rearmament was a necessary evil, a reaction to the mounting threat from Italy and especially Germany, as well as, in the Far East, Japan. Their international finance, trade and business could only be damaged by war and huge continental, if not global, disruption. Their interests lay in sustaining peace. This priority was reinforced in British eyes by the mounting and costly difficulties they faced in sustaining control over some of their overseas possessions. India, where they had to contend with continued pressure for independence, remained a major problem. Beyond this, beginning in 1936 and lasting for fully 3 years, they were engaged in the brutal suppression of a big Arab insurrection against colonial rule and Jewish settlement in the mandated territory in Palestine. It wasn't that the resources needed for the defence of the United Kingdom were hugely diverted to the Empire. French resources for the defence of their own colonies were even more subjugated to the pressing requirements of building up home defences against the obvious growing danger from across the Rhine. Nevertheless, imperial defence still meant that men and resources had to be provided. Britain's political and military leaders fully realised that the country's global defence commitments were greatly overstretched. Simultaneous war in three separate theatres against Italy, Germany, and Japan would present the nightmare scenario. This dire prospect drove the policy of appeasement, assuaging potential enemies, in which Britain took the lead and France followed. The ability to match Germany's accelerating rearmament program was a great source of anxiety. The state of air defences in particular was acutely worrying. Stanley Baldwin, the dominant figure in the British national government and, from June 1935, Prime Minister for the third time, had 3 years earlier done nothing to diminish the public fear of attacks from the air in the event of another war, when he had stated that the bomber will always get through. It had been at that time, in 1932, an expression of the futile hope that Britain might take the lead in outlawing bombing as part of international disarmament. As such hopes evaporated, and large-scale German rearmament had to be recognised as an ominous fact, fears were already voiced by the autumn of 1934 that British defences had been neglected and wouldn't be capable of matching a growing disparity in armed strength, especially in air power. Then, at a meeting in Berlin in March 1935, Hitler, with more concern for the effect than accuracy, had told the British Foreign Secretary, Sir John Simon, and Lord Privy Seal, a minister without portfolio, Anthony Eden, that Germany had already gained parity in air power with Britain. The result was great alarm in London. From this point onwards, those who still favoured disarmament, including most Liberals and Labour supporters, were gradually placed on the back foot. In June 1935, Baldwin replaced the ineffective Air Minister, Lord Londonderry, with the more energetic and forceful Sir Philip Cunliffe-Lister. The expansion and modernisation of the Air Force now acquired new urgency as part of a general and increasingly substantial extension of British rearmament. On their assessment of the German lead in armaments, British military planners looked to 1939 as the year of maximum danger, when Britain must be militarily ready to confront Germany. Some thought such timing illusory. There were dire warnings from within the military, keen, of course, to press the case for massively increased expenditure on rearmament, and within the high echelon of the Foreign Office, that Britain would by then be in no position to contain the threat of Germany. They pointed to a growing, not diminishing, disparity in arms, especially in the air. Worries were also expressed that tilting the economy too rapidly towards rearmament might necessitate tax rises and an increased cost of living. These, in turn, might threaten social stability, possibly even opening the door to a socialist-style, state-run, militarized economy. Opinion varied among political and military leaders on the severity of the threat from Germany, the point of gravest danger, and the intensity with which the effort to overcome the gap in military build-up had to be undertaken. The dominant view, however, was that it was crucial to play for time, avoid premature war, and, with luck, avoid war at all through clever diplomacy, implicitly meaning, without doubt, reaching an accommodation with Germany. The predominant economic as well as military arguments advanced pointed in the same direction, towards appeasement. The economic case for appeasement appealed even more to French ministers following the fall of Blum's Popular Front government in 1937. The austerity policies introduced in the attempt to stabilize state finances were incompatible with an expanded armaments program. The finance minister, Georges Bonnet, indicated that it was impossible to provide both guns and butter. Big rearmament programs would have to be cut back. France's liberal economy, he argued, could simply not compete with Germany's unconstrained spending on armaments. The defense budget for 1938 was actually reduced as a result. Armed forces chiefs complained in vain. The threat from the air, viewed in France as elsewhere as the greatest danger in any future war, was especially worrying. The restructuring of France's recently nationalized aircraft industry created production problems to add to the financial constraint. Only 370 aircraft were built in 1937, compared with Germany's 5,606. The air minister, Pierre Cot, widely viewed as a left-wing radical and unpopular because of his advocacy of a close alliance with the Soviet Union, said he needed a 60% increase in his budget to galvanize aircraft production. Given financial restraints, that was out of the question. Unsurprisingly, the French Air Force was gloomy about its prospects in a coming war. Its chief predicted in early 1938 that should war break out that year, the French Air Force would be annihilated in a few days. Acutely aware of both economic and military weakness, France's leaders were temperamentally attuned to the policy being forged in London of buying time through finding a way to come to terms with Hitler's Germany. By late 1937, the arms race that had been unleashed by Germany was taking on its own momentum and restricting political options among all the major powers. The contours of the extraordinary drama that would unfold over the following 2 years were taking shape. And in that drama, as the room for maneuver became objectively curtailed, the role played by a small number of key individuals would prove decisive. Hawks and Doves. In London, in November 1937, around the time that the meeting in the Reich Chancellery was taking place, Lord Halifax, leader of the House of Lords and soon to become British Foreign Secretary, was preparing to visit Hitler. He hoped to arrive at an accommodation with the German dictator over Central Europe. It was the first step in a more active appeasement policy that reflected the initiative of the new British Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, who had replaced Baldwin on the 28th of May. Baldwin might be thought to have retired from the premiership at a good moment. The previous December, he had deftly handled the abdication crisis when King Edward VIII had renounced the throne in favour of his brother, George VI, to marry an American divorcee, Mrs. Wallace Simpson. 2 weeks before Baldwin's resignation, the coronation of the new king had seen a momentary display of patriotic unity in the country, which was recovering from economic depression and had avoided the political extremism that had beset much of Europe. And Baldwin, increasingly worried about the prospect of war, resigned before he would have had to contend with a grave and prolonged international crisis that was about to grip Europe. When he met Hitler on the 19th of November, Halifax himself suggested that the British government would accept a change through peaceful evolution in the current status of Austria, Czechoslovakia, and Danzig, though it was keen to avoid far-reaching disturbances. This was music to Hitler's ears. He told Halifax he had no wish to annex Austria or reduce her to political dependence, and went on behind the scenes working towards exactly such an eventuality. Halifax noted in his diary that he found Hitler very sincere, wanting friendly relations with Britain. The cultured British aristocrat was plainly out of his depth with a political leader whose expressed solution to the problems that Britain was encountering in India was to shoot Gandhi and several hundred members of the Congress Party until order was restored. When he reported back to the British cabinet, Halifax assured ministers that Hitler had no immediate adventure in mind and suggested giving him some colonial territory to make him more amenable in Europe. Chamberlain thought Halifax's visit had been a great success. He told his sister in a private letter that though the Germans wanted to dominate Eastern Europe, he didn't see why agreement couldn't be reached as long as Germany rejected the use of force to deal with the Austrians and Czechoslovaks, and Britain gave assurances that it wouldn't act to prevent change by peaceful means. The minister most opposed to this new, more active form of appeasement, the search for accommodation with Germany through bilateral relations and concessions of territorial change in Central Europe, the Foreign Secretary, Anthony Eden, was from January 1938 ill and recuperating in the south of France. While he was away, the direction of foreign affairs was in Chamberlain's own hands. Worn out and in continuing conflict with Chamberlain, Eden resigned on the 20th of February 1938. His successor was the arch-appeaser, Lord Halifax. A British government, only too aware of its defence weaknesses and overstretched global commitments, and looking actively to find accommodation with Hitler, was by now the chief obstacle to German expansion in Europe. It wasn't an encouraging thought. In Paris, there was recognition by the time that Chotin, the Prime Minister, and his Foreign Minister, Yvon Delbos, travelled to London in November 1937 to hear an account of Halifax's meeting with Hitler, that French foreign policy was heavily subordinated to that of Britain. When the French asked whether its ally, Czechoslovakia, could reckon with British as well as French support in the event of the country becoming a victim of aggression, Chamberlain avoided any commitment, stating that Czechoslovakia was a long way off, and a country with which we had not a great deal in common. Chotin privately, in fact, acknowledged the inevitability of extended German influence in Central Europe at the expense of Austria and Czechoslovakia, and wasn't unhappy to let Britain make the running in appeasement. In Rome, Benito Mussolini could reflect in November 1937 on how he had been bedazzled by his state visit to Germany only a few weeks earlier, when Hitler had left no stone unturned in the successful endeavour to impress his Axis partner. Early in the month, Italy had signed the Anti-Comintern Pact, linking itself with the agreement signed the previous autumn between Germany and Japan. The pact was directed ostensibly against the Soviet Union. However, in his dealings with the Italians prior to them joining the pact, Hitler's foreign emissary and currently ambassador in London, Joachim von Ribbentrop, had indicated what was really behind the move. The British, he explained, had rejected the overtures to an Anglo-German rapprochement, the hope that had been behind Hitler sending Ribbentrop as his ambassador to London. The pact he led Mussolini and his foreign minister, Count Galeazzo Ciano, to understand, was in reality clearly anti-British, the preliminary basis of closer military ties between Germany, Italy, and Japan. Italy was being gripped ever more tightly in Germany's iron embrace. In January 1938, the Italian army was given a directive for the first time envisaging an alignment of Germany and Italy against Britain and France. The Italian armed forces, well aware of the inadequacies of their rearmament program, could only hope that war wouldn't come soon. In Moscow, Stalin had spent much of 1937 demolishing the Red Army's leadership through his great purges. It seemed sheer madness to outside observers. This was Hitler's view. "Must be exterminated," he remarked ominously to his propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels, that December. The Soviet Union was, however, not yet on his immediate agenda and hadn't figured in the scenarios he had painted to his military leaders a month earlier. Within the Soviet leadership, war with the capitalist powers, among which they included Germany and Italy, viewing fascism as the most extreme and aggressive form of capitalism, was seen as inevitable. There was a growing conviction that the Western democracies were encouraging Hitler to turn eastwards, to fight the war against communism for them. On his own eastern borders, Stalin also had concerns. Japanese militarism along the uneasy border between Manchukuo and the USSR was starting to pose a significant threat. The only question was when war would come. The longer it could be postponed, the better it would be for the Soviet Union. There was a long way to go before the Soviet military machine would be ready. In the meantime, Stalin's options were narrowing. Collective security, the policy advocated by his foreign minister, Maxim Litvinov, became ever less attractive in view of the evident weakness of the Western democracies and their readiness to contemplate accommodation with Hitler. An alternative, which would gradually gain weight, was to try to return to a form of rapprochement with Germany. The arrangement in the 1920s, following the 1922 Treaty of Rapallo, and using mutual economic advantage as a lever, offered a sort of precedent. But Hitler's visceral anti-Bolshevism, which he had again demonstrated as recently as the Nazi Party rally in September 1937, stood in the way of even indirect overtures. Stalin's third possibility was to accept Soviet isolation and increase still further the pace of rearmament, hoping that there would be no early descent into war. For the time being, this offered the only way forward. In the capitals of countries in Central and Eastern Europe, political leaders in the late autumn of 1937 were more than aware of a drastically shifting balance of power and their own limited options. Their dependence on actions of the major European powers that they couldn't control was obvious. Collective security through the League of Nations, as Abyssinia had shown, was long dead. France, once the guarantor of protection through its network of alliances, was gravely weakened, its internal divisions and economic problems plain to see. Britain, it was clear, had no major interest in preserving the status quo in Central Europe. German political as well as economic influence was filling the vacuum. National interest and mutual distrust or enmity posed barriers to military cooperation. And meanwhile, German strength was growing visibly, Central Europe being the obvious target for any expansionist moves. Nervousness and apprehension were tangible. In Vienna and Prague, there was particular cause for anxiety. Both Austria and Czechoslovakia were short of friends. The French, their foreign policy becoming heavily tied to Britain's, were less reliable allies of the Czechs than had once been the case. Austria, no longer with Italy's protection, was most likely to be Hitler's first target. A move would surely come soon. Far from Europe, too, there were momentous developments, eventually to have a profound impact on the continent. Since July 1937, Japan, increasingly militaristic and aggressive, had been fighting a bitter war in China. The atrocities perpetrated, among them the horrendous slaughter of Chinese civilians by rampaging Japanese troops in Nanking in December, shocked the world. They contributed to a gradual, if slow, decline in isolationist sentiment in the United States, where President Roosevelt had already signaled 3 months earlier the need to quarantine the aggressive powers that were threatening world peace. As yet, to the frustration of the British, whose interests in the Far East would be most directly endangered by Japanese aggression, no action followed from the USA. Even so, 1937 saw the beginning of the growing confrontation between Japan and America in the Pacific that would eventually bring both countries into a global conflict. And it saw the start of Roosevelt's awareness of the need to persuade American public opinion that any German aggression in Europe wasn't without consequences for the USA. On the 4th of February, 1938, sweeping changes in the political and military leadership of the German Reich were suddenly announced in Berlin. Blomberg, the war minister, and Fritsch, the commander-in-chief of the army, had been dismissed. Hitler himself had taken over at the head of a restructured high command of the Wehrmacht. His own supremacy was, as a result, even further enhanced. The position of the military leadership was significantly weakened. Those voicing fears of being plunged into war against the Western powers were greatly outnumbered by Hitler loyalists, won over by huge spending on rearmament, restored prestige, and Germany's enhanced international standing. Other powerful elites in the economy or in the high ranks of the state bureaucracy, whose hopes of a resurgent German dominance had never vanished, had overwhelmingly aligned themselves with Hitler's regime. The assertive foreign policy, exploiting the weakness and divisions of the Western democracies, had made Hitler a hugely popular dictator. The masses gave him the plebiscitary backing that enormously boosted his standing at home and abroad. An enormous, multi-layered Nazi movement provided the organizational underpinning of his rule and the apparatus to ensure the constant mobilization of mass support. The dictatorship was strong, secure, and not threatened by any significant opposition. The potential for organized resistance had long ago been quashed. Only a military coup could effectively challenge Hitler's mastery. Of that, there was as yet no sign. In the major restructuring of the regime's leadership in early February 1938, the other big departure alongside the military figures, Blomberg and Fritsch, was that of the conservative Neurath, replaced as foreign minister at a critical juncture by the hawkish Ribbentrop. He was known to echo Hitler's own views and, since his failure as ambassador in London, was bitterly anti-British. Further widespread changes were made in the upper ranks of the officer and diplomatic corps. Hitler now had personnel in key positions who were attuned to his high-risk foreign policy. Possible constraints on any decisions he might make had dwindled to insignificance. The likelihood of one bold move to be undertaken very soon was surmised by those around Hitler. The Austrian Chancellor Kurt von Schuschnigg ought to be trembling, one high-ranking officer in Hitler's entourage noted privately in his diary. Little over a month later, the Austrian government capitulated to intense pressure from Berlin. German troops crossed the Austrian border, and legislation to incorporate Austria into a Greater Germany was hastily drawn up. On the 15th of March, before a vast, ecstatic crowd in Vienna's Heldenplatz, Hitler announced the entry of my homeland into the German Reich. As he had foreseen, the Western democracies lamely protested, but otherwise did nothing. Nor did the subsequent ferociously brutal persecution of Austrian Jews and political opponents of the Nazis elicit any reaction from Paris or London, or deter the hopes of Neville Chamberlain that it might be possible someday for us to start peace talks again with the Germans. Czechoslovakia, its borders now exposed, was certain to be Hitler's next target. Britain and France had practically written off Austria long before it fell to the Germans. Czechoslovakia was a different matter. Its geographical position made it pivotal. It had an alliance with France, another with the Soviet Union, and France was Britain's ally. An attack on Czechoslovakia might well unleash a general European war. From a German perspective, Czechoslovakia's ties with both the West and the East, from a key position in Central Europe, pose a potentially serious strategic problem. Its raw materials and armaments would certainly be extremely valuable to German war preparations, but attacking Czechoslovakia was a high-risk enterprise. It could take Germany into war against the Western democracies, a war that some, among its military leaders, not least the Chief of Army's General Staff, General Ludwig Beck, were sure it couldn't win. Czechoslovakia, however, lacked powerful friends. Even as Germany was swallowing up Austria, the French government were being told by the Defence Minister, Édouard Daladier, that France could offer no direct military assistance to its Czech ally. France's military leaders dismissed at the same time any prospect of the Red Army coming to the aid of Czechoslovakia. A few weeks later, French leaders learned that Britain would provide no guarantee to take military action should the Germans attack Czechoslovakia. The stance of the Western powers throughout the summer of 1938 was set. France, whatever noises were made about standing behind its Czech ally, wouldn't act without Britain, and Britain would offer no prospect of military intervention. The Czechs were on their own. Their unenviable plight was made worse, in not dissimilar fashion to that of Austria's earlier, by unrest from within Czechoslovakia. Konrad Henlein, the leader of the increasingly Nazified German minority in the Sudetenland, badly treated by the Czech majority, though nowhere near as much as German propaganda claimed, was primed by Hitler to pose demands for autonomy that could never be satisfied by Prague. For the Western powers, some at least of the demands seemed reasonable. And when Hitler claimed to want no more than to bring persecuted Germans home into the Reich, it appeared that he was once more merely a nationalist politician, if an extreme and utterly intransigent one, who was pursuing the limited aim of incorporating another German ethnic bloc within the Reich. The lack of comprehension of Hitler's motives was a crucial component of the growing tragedy of Czechoslovakia. German ruthlessness, Czech helplessness, and Anglo-French feebleness all played their part in the drama that took Europe to the verge of another war. In a summer of bluff brinkmanship and unbearably mounting tension, Hitler was ready to risk war against the Western powers in order to destroy Czechoslovakia by force. Preparations for attack laid down the date of the 1st of October at the latest. for public consumption, Hitler turned up the volume of his ever more frenzied verbal assaults on the Czech government and openly stated that he had no further territorial demands in Europe beyond the solution of the Sudeten problem. Believing that Hitler wanted the incorporation of the Sudetenland into Germany but no more, Neville Chamberlain flew twice to Germany in mid-September for talks with Hitler. Chamberlain returned from his first visit on the 15th of September, optimistic that a deal was within reach. It amounted to the Czechs ceding the Sudetenland to Germany and Hitler renouncing the use of force. Chamberlain privately expressed the view that Hitler, though harsh and ruthless, was a man who could be relied upon when he had given his word. The British Prime Minister would be swiftly disabused of his presumption of Hitler's good faith. Britain and France had in the meantime exerted huge pressure upon the hapless Czechs, indicating that they couldn't rely on British or French support if it came to war, and compelling them to agree to territorial concessions. On the 21st of September, the Czechs finally capitulated with the deepest reluctance and profound sense of betrayal to the Anglo-French diktat. But for Hitler, it wasn't enough. At his second meeting with Chamberlain on the 22nd of September, he reneged on what the Prime Minister had taken as an agreement they had reached only a week earlier. He now demanded that they accept German occupation of the Sudetenland by the 1st of October, otherwise he would take it by force. He claimed to be indifferent to warnings from Britain that this could lead to war with the Western powers. Privately, however, Hitler was retreating from his intention to use military might to destroy Czechoslovakia in its entirety. The British and French were, after all, forcing the Czechs to give him what ostensibly he had wanted. With the Czechs browbeaten into accepting the mutilation of their country, the areas of disagreement with the Western powers were by now relatively minor. "You can't carry out a world war on account of modalities," was how Hitler's propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels succinctly put it. It very nearly came to war just the same. Hitler had pushed some in Chamberlain's cabinet, including the Foreign Secretary Lord Halifax, too far. On the 25th of September, they opposed acceptance of Hitler's ultimatum. The French and British agreed on the sending of an emissary to Berlin to warn Hitler that should he attack Czechoslovakia, it would mean war. The French started to mobilize. The British mobilized their fleet. The Soviets, too, were mobilizing. War looked ever more likely. Frantic efforts were made to summon a conference to work out a settlement. The breakthrough came when Mussolini intervened to broker a four-power conference of Germany, Italy, France, and Britain. The Soviet Union, distrusted on all sides, was left out in the cold. With that, the way was open for the climax of the drama in the Munich Agreement, signed on the 30th of September 1938. The Czechs weren't represented at the gathering of the big powers that proceeded to break up their country. The two Western democracies had forced another democracy to submit to the bullying of a dictator. "The government of the Czechoslovak Republic," ran the official announcement of the capitulation issued in Prague, "protested to the whole world against the decisions of Munich, which were taken one-sidedly and without Czechoslovak participation." The German humanist writer and publicist Frederick W. Nielsen, who had left Germany in October 1933 for exile in Prague in disgust at an inhumane regime, as he already saw it bent on war — he was later forced to move to Britain, then the USA — undoubtedly expressed the bitterness of the entire Czech population of his adopted country in the open letter he sent to Chamberlain and Daladier. "Don't deceive yourself," he wrote to the British Prime Minister. The same voices that give praise to your name today will curse you in the not-too-distant future, when it becomes clear what poison stems from the seed of this act of peace. His condemnation of de Ladier was no less pungent. The greatness of France, founded in the storm of the Bastille, has now, through your signature, become the laughing stock of the world. Hitler had gained what, on the surface at least, he had wanted. The occupation of the Sudetenland was to be carried out at once. The rest of Czechoslovakia, he had no doubt, could be taken at a later date. Peace had been preserved, but at what price? Both Chamberlain and Daladier returned home to delirious receptions. Only gradually did the shame of the capitulation to German bullying at the expense of the Czechs become widely acknowledged. Was there an alternative? On this, views differed at the time and have remained divided across the decades. Hitler held the aces in the high-stakes gamble, and Chamberlain had a poor hand. On this, there is little dispute. But how badly did he play his poor hand? The weakest card in Chamberlain's hand was the state of British rearmament. For Daladier, across the Channel, the position was even worse. In both cases, the military leadership had made plain that the armed forces weren't equipped to fight a war against Germany. In fact, both the French and the British exaggerated German arms strength. But their sense of gross inferiority in arms, especially in the air, was based on contemporary intelligence, not the benefits of hindsight. A strategic bombing campaign of the type so feared was actually quite beyond Germany's capability at the time. Other intelligence reports, emphasizing Germany's lack of raw materials and inadequate preparations for a major war, were ignored or downplayed. The military chiefs saw the outright priority in winning time to rearm. Even so, at the height of the crisis, on the 26th of September, the French commander-in-chief, General Maurice Gamelin, informed French and British leaders that, taken together, their military forces added to those of the Czechs were greater than those of the Germans. On the French border with Germany, should an offensive be required to draw the Germans away from Czechoslovakia, France had 23 divisions, compared with only 8 for Germany. If Italy joined in, Gamelin had notions of attacking to the south, launching an offensive across the Alpine border into the Po Valley, defeating the Italians, then marching north to Vienna and on to help the Czechs. Less reassuring was Gamelin's indication that, when facing the Germans, French troops would advance until they encountered serious opposition, then return to the Maginot defensive line. The French, especially, but the British military too, suffered from a misplaced inferiority complex towards the Germans. The underlying problem throughout, however, had been in essence political, not military. It had begun well before 1938. The British and French had advertised their weaknesses and their difficulties both in comprehending Hitler's aims and in how to deal with him on numerous occasions over the previous 5 years, most plainly during the remilitarization of the Rhineland in 1936. They'd done nothing to prevent Hitler's Germany becoming militarily strong. That was what Chamberlain had to contend with on becoming Prime Minister in May 1937. That, and the legacy of years in which Britain had sought to disarm rather than rearm, together with the balancing act during years of severe economic constraints of spreading the armed forces for duties in the Far East and the Mediterranean, as well as in home waters. Chamberlain was easily the most dominant figure in the Western democracies, given the internal turmoil and economic problems of the French. Moreover, he hadn't just a more proactive way of trying to accommodate German expansionist demands, but also an extraordinarily misplaced self-confidence that he knew what Hitler wanted, could handle him, and could cajole him into a peaceful settlement of Europe's problems. Chamberlain's personal imprint on British foreign policy, sometimes against the advice of experienced figures within the Foreign Office, reflected this conviction. A sign of his self-confidence was that on his first visit to Germany in mid-September, he negotiated alone with Hitler, one-on-one. His Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax, hadn't even accompanied him on the trip. In a later age, extensive international diplomacy would surely have been deployed in an attempt to defuse the critical situation. But this was long before transcontinental shuttle diplomacy. And with the League of Nations more or less defunct, there was no international body to intervene. The Dominions, having bled in one European war, had no appetite for another, and supported appeasement. The United States, still to emerge from its isolationism, watched from afar. Roosevelt had appealed for peace during the summer of 1938, but did no more than that. Chamberlain, his anti-American feelings never far beneath the surface, was dismissive of the prospect of any help from the USA. In any case, American military weakness left the United States in no position to intervene, even had the willingness been there. As it was, Roosevelt cabled "good man" to Chamberlain on hearing that he was going to the Munich conference. The president, inconsequentially, then compared the outcome, which had been utterly predictable, to Judas's betrayal of Jesus. The center of the drama focused therefore heavily upon the personal duel of Hitler and Chamberlain, a historic mismatch, if ever there was one. Chamberlain's belief that he could negotiate a peaceful outcome with Hitler had wavered only when he encountered the opposition of the loyal Halifax and others in his cabinet on return from his second visit to Germany. That belief had returned by the time of the Munich conference to the point where Chamberlain thought that by obtaining Hitler's signature on a worthless piece of paper, flaunted on his return to England, he had attained peace in our time. He later regretted his exuberance, expressed under the influence of the rapturous crowds in London, and was hard-headed enough to imagine that he had only deferred, rather, than prevented war. He insisted, until his death in 1940, that to have fought in 1938 would have been far worse than postponing, if not averting, war. Britain wasn't ready, he insisted. He had to gain time. Whether, despite the warnings of military leaders, Britain and France would have been better off fighting in 1938, than waiting another year, has been endlessly debated. It was indeed only in 1939 that British and French military spending came close to matching that of Germany, and only in that year that the two democracies began serious wartime planning. But Germany, too, had been rearming strongly that year, on top of the four previous years of intensive rearmament, and was also far better equipped to fight than it had been in 1938. This was reinforced by the destruction of Czech military power and the acquisition of new sources of raw materials and armaments from former Czechoslovakia. The balance of forces had, in fact, in some respects by 1939, tipped somewhat towards Germany. Whether the Munich debacle could have been avoided has also been debated since those very days. Winston Churchill, the long-standing but largely isolated opponent of appeasement, had been the most outspoken voice in 1938, pleading for a grand alliance with the Soviet Union and Eastern European countries to deter Hitler. He later argued strongly that war wouldn't have been necessary had deterrence, not appeasement, been the strategy. The Labour Party and many others on the left supported the idea of the Grand Alliance. The deep distrust, as well as embedded detestation of the Soviet Union embellished by gruesome reports of Stalin's purges, meant, however, that such a strategy never had a chance of winning the support of the British or the French government.